takers. We have a mandate from Catherine Calderwood to make policy, inform policy, to be a pain in the neck to the government, to lobby them, to tell them what's happening. We have representatives from the government at the back. You all heard it here, people. Catherine says that we are the people. And I'm desperately trying to right-click this button to bring up an embarrassing picture of Catherine, but not, it's not behaving. So that was the first thing. Another action point was brought up by a colleague about school buttons. Left. Ah, it's left and not right. Okay. I've pinched this from the Twitter feed. The other action point was, I think Catherine and colleagues were also going to look at how uptake of the baby boxes was mapped out across socioeconomic status. Not quite sure how easy that would be, but I think there was an important raise there. Then we went into the second half of the morning when this mob here sat at the table. You can see the picture there, looking very attentive there. And this was very much looking at how do we create a level playing field. And the action points that I took here was that we as a community and also as a wider society need to address and to tackle assumptions that we make about children who are vulnerable. Social exclusion is also an important thing that we need to be aware of and to help tackle. And a very practical take-home point was raised right towards the end of the discussion about how we can have standardisation of the health needs assessment across all 14 boards. And I need to invite people to take up that challenge because I think that would be a really neat take-home message. I think there seems to be some work already done that perhaps has just been parked somewhere. I think we can revitalise that. That would be good. Then we had a bit of lunch. Very nice lunch. This is from the Twitter account. There's been a fair bit of tweeting from the lady at the back, I suspect. So I now need to talk about something that I'm totally unqualified to talk about, which is mental health and well-being. We've heard this morning, these are the reflections from this morning, that mental health is important in mothers who are pregnant. As a carrier of a Y chromosome, I also say that mental health being is important in fathers too. It's important in children and young people, and also in neonates. We've heard this morning that mental health is particularly important in looked-after children with learning disabilities, but the detection, rather like poor vision, can be a big challenge. And also, something that I think we're all apparent is that the services that deliver, the CAM service in particular, is creaking. It's under huge pressure. That pressure is probably going to get greater before it becomes less. I can talk with a little bit of experience from the State of Child Health, which is the college's line in the sand. We drew this line in the sand, dated January this year, to say where we were. And interestingly, we did it across the four devolved countries, and there's nothing quite like comparing your neighbours to motivate people to change. In there, the college identifies that we need to maximise women's health before, during and after pregnancy, including mum's mental health. There's a statement in here that acknowledges and recognises the need to offer children and young people an option in schools to discuss and perhaps disclose to some trained people mental health and well-being issues. And there's a whole chapter on maximising mental health and well-being throughout childhood. And increasingly, we're all becoming aware that the mental illness and mental well-being obviously have a bit of overlap, but the drivers to that and the solutions are rather different. So, it's always dangerous feeding people well, because as a species, we tend to get a bit sleepy afterwards. But I'm very keen that we all keep our focus on what's happening this afternoon. Here's the list for this afternoon. So I'm delighted that Helen's here to come and talk to us for half an hour. And then we have a panel here who are going to talk for 10 minutes each on the issue that you see here. And then as this morning, we'll have a 15-20 minute discussion thereafter. Again, I'm delighted to see all of the questions that are arising. Keep those questions coming, and we'll make this not only an enjoyable meeting, but a meeting that helps the health of children in this country, which is really why we're all here. So, without any ado, I would like to invite Helen to come and take over. Thank you very much.
So first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to come and talk to a subject that's very dear to my heart. I've been working in the field of child mental health for my whole career, and I've become quite obsessed in the last few years about the children that are kind of hiding under rocks with problems and we don't know about. Can people hear me? It feels quite echoey. Is it okay? Okay, great. So now, I know that this was spoken about this morning, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but this study about adverse childhood experiences really has rocked medicine and science and sociology, because it's really shown very convincingly that early adversities, abuse, neglect, and household dysfunction, when they pile up, can become very problematic, and that there are dose-response relationships with things that we would expect, like depression. So, for example, if you have five adversities in early childhood, then you're five times as likely to become depressed as an adult. That was kind of old news. We kind of knew that. But this was news, that if you have seven or eight adversities, then you're more than three times as likely to develop heart disease. So this was a shock to people. It was great for child and adolescent mental health, because it made people realize that we need to be thinking about adverse childhood experiences during childhood. But I also want to remind you that many of us in this room will have experienced one, two, three, maybe four of these adversities, and we're doing fine. That's very typical. Many of us have experienced divorce or a parent with a mental illness, for example, but it's when the load gets too big that problems seem to emerge. So I like to think about it as the load of ACEs that the child is carrying. And when I see young children who've been abused or neglected, I want to be thinking about how to prevent them getting more adversities piled on top of their existing load. So I noticed a few years ago that children who had been abused and neglected, who were coming to see me clinically, seemed to have particularly complex problems. And I launched this term, maltreatment-associated psychiatric problems, to describe my clinical impression, and we then went on to test this a bit. So this is what my clinical impression was, that this was particularly from a study of adopted children that we did, but since then we've found this to be the case in children who are not in adoptive placements but who've experienced a lot of adversity. And so it was a study of adopted children who had the symptom of indiscriminate friendliness, and that symptom is directly associated with abuse and neglect. And what we found was that many of those children had complex, overlapping psychiatric problems. Often these were neurodevelopmental problems like autism, or something that maybe looked a little bit like autism or ADHD. And I should say that things like autism-like traits, nobody thinks that they're caused by maltreatment. I mean, there's been lots of research, and autism is very, very strongly heritable. So that was a puzzle. And then attachment disorders were common in this group, and attachment disorders are characterized by either indiscriminate friendliness on the one hand, or a failure to seek comfort on the other. And a child who doesn't seek comfort is at a big disadvantage, because our tendency to seek comfort, in other words, to exhibit attachment behavior, is what pulls in help through development from parents and other loved ones. But we found that any psychiatric disorder seemed to be common in this group. And I was just struck at the burden of different psychiatric disorders that this group seemed to have. I really began to think, am I imagining this? So we did a study with a group of colleagues in Sweden. In Sweden, they've got this absolutely massive twin study, and a twin study is a beautiful opportunity to understand the environment, so nurture, and other environmental factors, and also nature in terms of genetics. So we wanted to have a look at the group in the population, and they were talking about 13,000 twins at the age of 9. We wanted to look at the group who were maltreated and compare them with the group that weren't maltreated. And I guess our question was, does the maltreated group actually have more of these neurodevelopmental disorders, or is that just me imagining things? And if you're interested, you can look up Dinkler and Minnis. And in fact, the methodology is really complicated. So what Lisa and I did, Lisa isn't a clinician, so she was as confused about the clinical stuff as I was about the behavioural genetics. So there's a little YouTube. And if you look up Dinkler, Minnis, JCPP, because that's the journal that it's in, on YouTube, you can see Lisa and I asking each other stupid questions. So essentially what we wanted to ask was, is child maltreatment a risk factor for an increased load of neurodevelopmental disorders when you control for other family effects? So the question is that load bigger? Now, Lisa did that, wasn't me, I'm not technical enough. So, just a little bit about the twins. Age 9, just about half female, half male. All the information was reported by parents. But I have to say, there have been other studies that have shown that parents are actually pretty good at reporting about maltreatment. So if they say, my child is maltreated, then it's usually true. And we had a very good measure of neurodevelopmental disorders that's been validated against face-to-face clinical diagnosis. So, first of all, it looked as if the maltreated children did have a higher degree of neurodevelopmental complexity. So, you can see the red bar is the maltreated children, CM is child maltreatment. So they were significantly more likely to have a higher load of neurodevelopmental disorders. So you can see the proportion of children in the maltreated group with one neurodevelopmental disorder was significantly higher, 6 times as high. The proportion of children with 2 was 8 times as high. And this really surprised me. The proportion of children with 3 neurodevelopmental disorders was nearly 10 times as high in the maltreated children. And so what we measured in this study was symptoms of ADHD, autism, learning disabilities, and tic disorders. And none of these things are things that you would traditionally think of as being caused by maltreatment. So that was the $6 million question. Now, don't worry, don't panic. This is our beautiful diagram. But boy, did I have to get my head around it. So don't worry, I'll talk you through it. The way a twin study works is you look at how similar identical twins are for the thing that you're interested in compared to non-identical twins. But let's just focus on the left-hand side of the slide there. You can see the MZ, the identical twins. And those are twins, the pairs there are twins where one twin has been maltreated and the other hasn't. And if maltreatment was causing this neurodevelopmental complexity, then you would expect the maltreated twin to have more neurodevelopmental disorders. So I should have a drum roll here. Well, that's not what we found. So if you can see all the little colored dots, see over on the very left-hand diagram, just focus on that. The twins that don't have maltreatment, which are the ones that are not highlighted in red, they've got just as many colored dots, which is the neurodevelopmental disorders of the ones that weren't maltreated. So in other words, don't worry, we've got messages from space. So in other words, our results seem to show that maltreatment didn't cause this neurodevelopmental complexity. That was really a surprise to us. So I had always remembered, for example, that in the studies of Romanian orphans who grew up in those awful orphanages under Ceausescu, there was a higher rate of ADHD. And I had always imagined that even though we know that ADHD is strongly genetically determined, I had always imagined that maybe there was a kind of environmental route in as well, and it was maybe to do with damage to your frontal temporal lobes or whatever. This now makes me revise my thinking a bit. I mean, it's only one study, so, you know, we could be wrong, but I worked in an orphanage before I went into psychiatry, and it suddenly occurred to me, I thought, my goodness, I wonder if some of these children who were abandoned, because there was a big, high rate of child abandonment in the orphanage that I worked with and also in those Romanian orphanages, and I wonder if some of them had parents with ADHD who maybe did it impulsively. And certainly they were encouraged to by the orphanage staff where I worked, I hate to say. So it's maybe made me think again, perhaps this is not an environmental effect of maltreatment. And it looks from our studies, though, that there are genetic factors that are causing both the maltreatment and this neurodevelopmental complexity. We don't know what that is from this study, and we want to look at that in future research, but I suppose we're just wondering whether it could be at least partly to do with this, a situation where you've got parents with neurodevelopmental disorders who are perhaps impulsive and, you know, perhaps have a bit of a low tolerance because of ADHD, for example, and then they have children who are very hard to look after because of hyperactivity and impulsivity. And perhaps that's a difficult mixture. So back to my idea of maltreatment-associated psychiatric problems. So I think one of the things we can confidently see from this study is that that does exist. If you have psychiatric problems in the context of maltreatment, then the problems are often complex and overlapping. That's an awful word, comorbid. That's a very psychiatric word. It just means overlapping. Before I go on, though, I want to remind you that not all maltreated children, not all abused and neglected children develop any psychiatric disorders, and that's another really interesting conundrum. We know that across the lifespan, about 20% of people who've been maltreated don't have any psychiatric problems. But if you do have psychiatric problems, you tend to have complex overlapping ones. That is puzzling. So these problems don't seem to be caused by maltreatment. And as I just said, it may be that the mixture of problems in the family might be evoking situations where maltreatment is more likely. Of course, I also want to say there that there are plenty of families like my own, where you have parents and children with neurodevelopmental problems and there's no maltreatment. So obviously other things have to be going on as well. So what are the implications of this? I think the implications of this are really quite profound, because it certainly for me turned on its head the way I'd been thinking about these things. I think what this means is that all children who've experienced significant adversity must be carefully assessed for neurodevelopmental disorders, and that certainly isn't happening. I hear many, many stories, and it's a bit of a postcode lottery, it doesn't happen everywhere, but I certainly hear plenty of stories where it's less likely if you've been maltreated that you're going to be assessed by CAMHS, because people will be saying, well, that's social. You know, it's obvious that they're going to have problems. It's obvious they're going to have aggressive behavior because of what they've experienced. But what we need to remember is that there could be other things driving this. And then I think there's an implication really across for our work across the lifespan. There's a lot of talk about trauma-related disorders. And again, both children and adults with trauma-related disorders, we need to be thinking about neurodevelopmental problems. So, for example, if you're a clinician, you've got an adult patient with borderline personality disorder, for example, who's self-harming and who, you know, has had lots of different antidepressants and they haven't worked, just stop and think for a moment, could that person perhaps also have autism? Could that be something to do with the problems with social interaction? So just think about that. And then for me, this is really important. I've been chatting, I've worked a lot with colleagues from NSPCC, and their whole mission is reducing maltreatment, reducing abuse and neglect in the population. And I just wonder whether we're missing a trick. I think there are probably a lot of adults out there who could really do with help for their neurodevelopmental disorders, and that help might actually help them get on with their children better. So that's something to think about. But what I wanted to really focus us on for a moment is, where are these children? Where are the children who have maltreatment-associated psychiatric problems in the population? I think the answer is we don't know. So we did a study, it's a good few years ago now, in North Glasgow, and we had fantastic buy-in from education. So we did a total population screening of 6 and 7 year old children, so primary 2 and 3 children in all 29 schools in North Glasgow. Now, I am a proud resident of North Glasgow, but there are very few pockets where relatively wealthy people like me live. North Glasgow generally is very materially deprived. And so we managed to get incredible buy-in from schools. We got 99% of teachers filling in questionnaires about the children they work with. And then we got just over half of the parents that we wanted to then follow up. So what we did was we looked at all the children who had high questionnaire scores for these attachment disorders. These are these disorders that are specifically related to abuse and neglect. And then a random sample of the rest, and we did home visits, and we were very persistent. If people had said, come and visit us, we certainly did. And then we did face-to-face assessments of the children in school. And what we found out of those 1,700 children was 23 children with an attachment disorder. But the really interesting thing that I hadn't expected in this study was that every single one of those 23 children had at least one other psychiatric disorder. And it could be almost anything. So there was a lot of ADHD, there was quite a lot of oppositional defiant disorder. I should not use the acronym ODD, it's a silly acronym. Conduct disorder. Conduct disorder in 6 and 7 year olds is quite unusual because you've got to be doing some quite significant things. You've got to be like hitting people in the playground or whatever. A bit of post-traumatic stress disorder, little sprinkling of autism, and even one child with a tic disorder. But now this is the most important finding, I think, in this study, and of course it wasn't what we set out to look at. But these children that we did home visits with their parents to ask detailed, semi-structured interviews with, every single one of those parents had invited us to come. They gave us, they actually sent forms back to the school and said, yes, we'd like to see you. But it took up to 12 home visits before we actually caught them in the house. And the really interesting thing was every single parent was really glad to see us. So I think I'd always had an impression, being a CAMHS clinician, that maybe there was a kind of passive aggression going on. And if somebody really, you know, wasn't in a couple of times when you visited them, it was because they didn't want to see you. Not the case. For me, the really stick-in-the-mind anecdote was one of the research assistants, it was her 7th home visit, and we always put a big note through the door saying, phone this number, or email this email, or text this number if you don't want us to come back. So they had plenty of opportunity to tell us that. So it was her 7th home visit, and this woman was having a tattoo on her inner thigh. And she says, oh, just come in here, I've been meaning to contact you, just sit there and he'll carry on, you do your interview. So it really made me realise that these were families, and this was not just the families whose children had problems, this was also the control group families, but these were families living in material deprivation. They have really stressful, really complicated lives, and they intend to get back to us, and it just doesn't happen because so much else is happening. I think that is really, really important. Because we talk constantly about looked after and accommodated children, but we found in this study that only half of the children with an attachment disorder, and this is an attachment disorder that's specifically associated with abuse and neglect, only half of those children were looked after. The other half were living with grands or aunties or birth parents. And those are the children that I think we really need to be concerned about. We spoke to the local CAMHS team about this study. I brought cake because I thought they're not going to like us finding all these new cases for them. But I was absolutely wrong. They said, no, we want to see these children when they're 6 and 7. We don't want to see them when they get pulled out of the canal at 14. So it's not that the CAMHS teams or the social workers are not motivated to see these children. We just haven't worked out how to do it. So just briefly, Is it worth doing this? Is it worth finding these children? And the answer is yes. We know that you can actually treat these problems, and we know that the most effective intervention is loving family care. And we know that from the studies that I just mentioned of the follow-ups of children who had been in those awful orphanages and are now adopted. And there's also randomised controlled trial evidence that just training foster carers, and now she's also done the same work with birth parents, to be a little bit extra nurturing for these children with attachment disorders. So these children who are not good at seeking comfort because of their early experiences, just training them to be a little bit extra nurturing, to give the child what they need, not what they're asking for. So for example, if they skin their knee and they don't draw your attention to it, you say to them, come over and I'll sort that, honey. Come here, come here. So you have to be a little, tiny little bit intrusive. That is actually effective at reducing the abnormalities in the stress response system that have been shown to be associated with abuse and neglect. So we can't treat these problems if we get in early enough. And we're doing a study just now that's asking the question, is introducing an infant mental health service for maltreated children who are coming into foster care and a cost-effective way of helping with their mental health problems? Don't know the answer yet. What the team does is try to treat the birth parents' problems so that they can become nurturing enough to have the children back. So you have to watch the space for that. But then the question that I'm also often asked, or I sometimes just see it on colleagues' faces, is, if we open the clinic doors to these children, will there be a tsunami? No, absolutely not. So just to remind you, we screened 1,700 six and seven-year-olds in North Glasgow, and we found 23 children with these complex and overlapping problems. And when we looked at the distribution of mental health problems in the rest of the children, it was identical to the general population of the UK, even though they were living in poverty. So if we could find the few children in the population soon enough to treat their problems, we could make a massive difference. So many of you will have heard of the Dunedin studies that have followed New Zealand adults from Dunedin in New Zealand from the age of 3 right up to adulthood. And they showed that the small group of individuals who were very aggressive at the age of 3, when they got to adulthood, they were committing 50% of the crime. So finding these children and helping them early would be good for all of us. So in other words, we need to find and polish our gems because these children are precious. I'm going to have to put a lot of effort in. How do we do it? And, you know, I really don't think we've worked this out, but from my research work and the work that we've been doing working with abused and neglected children, it does seem to me that there's something really to be said for getting agencies together talking about children on a case-by-case basis. So these are just ideas that I'd like to pitch, but what about screening in schools? And interestingly, we've been discussing this in Glasgow, and actually we do have systems set up for this in schools. I think for example, we've got the joint support teams in the schools. Often they do know the problems that the children that we should be worrying about. What they sometimes struggle with is who then to link with. We need to find a way of supporting CAMHS in assertive outreach with young children. And I'm not suggesting that I've got solutions of how we do that, particularly in this funding climate, but I think it's likely to be very cost effective. We need to link with our voluntary sector colleagues, so organisations like NSPCC, Children First, all sorts of voluntary organisations are actually doing this very well. And we need to be working with social workers. In Glasgow, I'm really proud to say we've got really good working relationships around abused and neglected young children between health and social work and the voluntary sector. And we've got a system now that's around our study where we're actually discussing individual children on a case-by-case basis, on a regular basis, and just trying to troubleshoot. So I think really what I would want to leave you with is that there's a small group, and it's a small group of children that really need our help early, and we need to find ways of finding those children and supporting their families. I'll leave you there.